Okay, well, welcome back to part two of our ethics refresher. In the first half of the program, which we're recording live today on December 2nd, 2021, in the first half of the program, we covered up through Rule 1.8, we're about at the halfway point, or actually a little bit past the halfway point, and if you're following along, you'll see, well, wait a minute, we're not anywhere near halfway through the material. So the material starting with Rule 1 is kind of, we go into a little bit more detail. As we see, we'll speed up here through some of the rules. So believe it or not, in our 3 hours today, we will get through all of the material. And we're starting with Rule 1.9 for this second portion of the program, talking about your duties to your former clients. And in general, we don't have to look too much detail what the actual text of Rule 1.9 has to say, because the vast majority of the cases, questions regarding what are your duties to your former client come under the heading of confidentiality. Because remember, everything you know about your client under Rule 1.6, everything is presumptively confidential. Everything you know is a confidential fact. And you're not allowed to disclose that to anybody. Well, that confidentiality remains even after the client becomes a former client. So that settles most of the cases. You know, so can you take a case against your former client? Well, probably not. And the reason why not is because everything you know about your former client is confidential, even if that's public knowledge for any other lawyer. So in other words, you're really not able to serve your present client properly because you are not allowed to use information that any other lawyer would be able to use. So for that reason, in general, it's impossible to have cases against your former client. There might be some very, very rare exceptions where that information is now so stale that you don't have to worry about it anymore. But in general, Rule 1.9, the answer is no. You can't pursue cases against your former client. Okay, as I noted just in passing at the end of the first segment of the program, all conflicts of interest are imputed. So in other words, a conflict of interest is not something that you hold personally as an attorney. A conflict of interest is something that is held by your firm. So if you are in a law firm, or if you have an employee, or if you are the employee and you work for another attorney, or if you have associates working in your same law firm, if you have a conflict of interest, then all of the attorneys in your firm have that same conflict of interest. So if I have a conflict of interest and I can't take the Smith case because Smith was my former client, now we can't sue Smith, you can't sue Smith either because that conflict of interest is imputed to you. And that's the general rule. Rule 1.10 and the following rules talk a little bit about the situation of, though, how does that affect it when you change jobs? So in other words, you have this conflict of interest and, you get a new job. Does that conflict of interest belong to your new employer? And the answer is, in general, yes. And it's your personal baggage that you bring with you to that new job. So in other words, let's say I'm here in Minnesota, and who is one of our largest employers in the state is 3M Corporation, makers of many fine products. And let's just say, for the sake of this hypothetical, that I was the general counsel for 3M Corporation. I was an attorney for 3M, I did all kinds of work for 3M over the years. 3M was my former client. Well, under Rule 1.9, I can't have cases against my former client because all the information I know about my former client, including the fact that Post-it notes are yellow, that information is confidential. I'm not allowed to disclose that because that's information I gained during the course of my previous representation. So I can't have cases against 3M Corporation. But I come to work for you. You decide to give me a job, and I get I bring in my potted plants and everything and get set up in my new office down the hall from you, and I work for you now. Well, the day after you hire me, you have a potential client hobble into your office, and they were damaged by a defective Post-it note. They have a multi-million dollar case against 3M. And so they come in and they start telling you this tragic story about how they were injured by this Post-it note, because it turns out there was, toxic waste on the back of it. That's, the stuff that they put on the Post-it notes to make them sticky. So they were just horribly injured, and they have this multi-million dollar case. So they start telling you about this case, and you say, well, wait a minute, I'm sorry. We can't take your multi-million dollar case because Attorney Clem worked for us. And so we have a conflict of interest. You're going to have to take your multi-million dollar case elsewhere. But before you say that, you think to yourself, what is more important to the future of my law firm? Is it this new client that just walked in with a multi-million dollar case? Or is an Attorney Clem, who we just hired yesterday? And so you think about that for about 1 second. And so instead of telling the client, I'm sorry, we can't take your case, you say, excuse me just a moment, I need to go do something else. And you walk down the hall to my office and you say, Clem, you're fired. Get out of here right now. And so I pack up, I take all my stuff away, and I don't work for you anymore. Well, Rule 1.10 says that conflict of interest that I brought with me to the new job, when I leave your employment, I take that conflict of interest with me. So in other words, we don't have to worry about the former clients of our former lawyers. Now, it would be different if I represented 3M while I worked for you, because then it would be your conflict of interest from the beginning. But in general, conflicts of interest follow me in that way. Now, there might be an exception if it was just some minor and isolated service. I wasn't, their attorney. I just helped them negotiate a residential lease at one point or something. It would be different. But in general, conflicts of interest I bring with me to my new job, I take with me when I leave. So that's Rule 1.10. Now, Rules 1.11 and 1.12 talk about the situation of my former client was not in the private sector, but my former client was in the public sector. So, in other words, I was not the attorney for 3M Corporation. I was a prosecuting attorney, and I worked I worked in the Dane County Prosecutor's Office in Wisconsin. I was an assistant county attorney, and I prosecuted cases in Wisconsin. Well, who is my former client? So we have to say, okay, well, so turn to Rule 1.10. Who was my former client? Well, my former client was the state of Wisconsin. So does that mean I can never have another case ever for the rest of my life against the state of Wisconsin? Well, that doesn't really make any sense. So, excuse me, in the case of a former government client, you instead look at Rule 1.11. And a little bit different rule applies. You don't worry about who the former client was. You instead worry about the particular cases that I was involved in. So, in other words, I was the prosecutor in the case of State of Wisconsin versus John Smith. So that means I can't switch sides and become John Smith's attorney, but I can have other cases against my former client, State of Wisconsin. So then that just is kind of a common sense rule because, technically the State of Wisconsin was my client, but that doesn't prohibit me from practicing criminal law for the rest of my life. So it's a little bit kind of a common sense provision. Even that common sense provision, though, might be problematic in some cases because if, I was an overworked county attorney. I had, thousands of files piled on my desk. I was involved in all kinds of cases. And there's only a certain number of criminal defense firms in town. And I had cases against all of them. So does that mean I can't go to work for any of those firms? And so in other words, I want to get a job not defending John Smith, who I used to prosecute, but I want to go to work for the law firm that is representing him. Can I do that? And the answer to that question is yes. But I have to be screened off from any involvement whatsoever with the Smith case, and I can't share any portion of the fee. So you're the law firm that represents John Smith, who I used to prosecute. You decided to hire me. That's okay. But you're not allowed to talk to me about that one case. But other cases, I can go up against my former employer, the state of Wisconsin. So it's kind of a common sense rule. Makes a lot of sense. And basically the same rule applies to judges under Rule 1.12. So if I was the judge presiding over the state of Wisconsin versus Smith, I can still go to work for Smith's law firm, but I have to be screened off from that particular case. Now, the other topic addressed by Rule 1.12 also applies if you're an arbitrator or mediator. So even if you're not a judge, but you ever serve as an arbitrator or mediator, or some kind of alternative dispute resolution person, you have to keep in mind that Rule 1.12 applies to you. Now, the other subject addressed, kind of an unrelated topic addressed by Rule 1.11, is former government employees of any type, not necessarily former government lawyers. So I used to work for the IRS, or I used to work, some government agency. During the course of my government employment, I have access to all kinds of confidential information, which is not confidential because of the attorney-client privilege. It's confidential because of some other law. Well, Rule 1.11 just makes clear that I can't use that confidential information in the private practice of law. And the here, I guess I don't have to use a hypothetical. I can use a real example because I've never worked for the government, really. Except I do. I become a government employee one day a year. I take off my private sector hat, and I go to work for the government on election day. I go to work as an election judge. And here, incidentally, is where I put in the public service announcement that whatever state or county you live in, I'm sure your state is always desperately looking for people to work on election day as poll workers and election judges or whatever they happen to call them in your state. So I encourage you to call up your state or county or however they work it where you are, your election office, and say, hey, do you need people to work as on election day? And I'm pretty sure they'll tell you yes. They'll probably get minimum wage, but minimum wage sure adds up when you report to work at 5:30 in the morning and work until 9 at night. So you actually make a little bit of money, but kind of an important service, and lawyers, that's one way you can really, as a practical matter, serve your community. So I'll put that plug in there. But anyway, I go to work as an election judge, and I have access to all kinds of confidential information. So for example, let's say I'm working on this collection matter, and this debtor absconded, and we're trying to track them down, figure out where to serve them. I have access to this statewide computer system, so I can kind of type in his name and say, "Oh, this is where he lives now," and just make a mental note of where this guy lives, so we can serve him with the complaint after. When I get back to the office. Well, what will happen if I do that? A couple things will happen. Number one is I'd probably get fired because they told us, no, you're not allowed to use that confidential information for that purpose. Number two, I could very well face criminal charges for doing that because there are criminal statutes involved that say you're not supposed to use that confidential information in certain ways. And number three, I would get disbarred because this rule says I'm not supposed to do that. So you can't use confidential information gained during your government employment to represent anybody adverse to them in any way. So uh, So that's the other subject covered by Rule 1.11. If you ever work as a government employee of any kind. One issue that comes up is, what if you're a part-time prosecutor? Can you still take criminal defense work? The state rule might vary slightly. In general, Iowa wrote right into the rules, no, you can't do it. So you can't have criminal defense work and serve as a prosecutor. Some states it might be okay. Some states it might you probably can practice as a defense attorney in a different county or something. So if your law firm gets the contract to prosecute misdemeanors some city or whatever, you have to watch out for that. That very well might dampen your ability to serve as a criminal defense attorney. Okay, Rule 1.13 talks about organization as your client. It says a couple of things. One is it reaffirms the common law rule that says that if you're representing an organization, well, then your client is the organization, and you do not thereby owe any duties to individuals within the organization. Unless you're representing them as a separate representation. So, yes, you can represent both the corporation and employees of the corporation, or you can represent, the corporation and the CEO, but keep in mind that is a case of separate representation. The mere fact that you are representing the corporation, you do not owe any duties to individuals within the organization, with one exception, and that exception is if individuals within the organization, such as employees, are under the mistaken impression that you are representing their interest, then you have to clear up that misapprehension. So if if you're representing the trucking company, and the truck driver thinks that you are acting in his interest and you're not, well, you have to clear up that misunderstanding and say, no, I'm not your attorney. Maybe you should find your own attorney. That's what Rule 1.15 has to say, 1.13. The other thing that Rule 1.13 talks about is, well, you in some situations have an obligation to be a whistleblower. And that's kind of a theoretical construct because if you're the attorney for the corporation, you always have to act in the corporation's best interest. And so if your corporation is dumping toxic waste, for example, well, that's not in your client's best interest because eventually they're going to, get fined $1 million or whatever for dumping this toxic waste. Well, but what if you learn about the dumping of the toxic waste? And it's kind of a secret, but that kind of puts you in a difficult position because your client isn't dumping toxic waste because the corporation doesn't have arms to pick up the waste and dump it into something. So your client isn't doing it. Some employee of your client is doing it. So basically you kind of rely on this fiction that, well, your client is not doing anything wrong. Some employee of your client is doing something wrong. They go out under cover of darkness and dump the toxic waste into the ditch. Well, that's an employee doing it, and you kind of operate under the legal fiction that that is not authorized by your client, the corporation. So what do you learn about this? You learn that this rogue employee, and you have the, I guess you have kind of the luxury of treating him as a rogue employee. You say this rogue employee is getting my client into trouble. So you have a duty to your client to put an end to that. And in general, you resolve that by going to your boss and say, hey, boss, I just discovered there's dumping of toxic waste going on. And in a perfect world, your boss will say, well, that's terrible. Let's make sure this stops. But in an imperfect world, your boss might blow it off. Well, you still have a duty to keep going up the chain of command to make sure illegal conduct is put to an end. Well, what if you get fired? Well, normally when your client says the magic words, you're fired, you owe no more duty to them at that point whatsoever, and you go home and they're on their own. In this case, though, in the case of a corporation, if you are fired because you're trying to point out illegal conduct, you owe a continuing duty to still continue to try to put an end to the misconduct. So if you get fired for pointing out this illegal conduct, you have a duty to go to your to the head honcho in the company and try to put an end to this. And what if they blow you off? Well, then you possibly have an obligation to go to the regulatory authorities. So your client, or your now former client, is dumping this toxic waste every night. Well, what happens if you call up the EPA and say, "Hey EPA, if you go out to this location tonight, you'll see my former client dumping toxic waste." What will happen if you make that phone call? Well, two things will happen. Number one, your client gets a $1 million fine for dumping it that day. Well, you're not supposed to get your client in trouble by getting the $1 million fine. But the other thing that will happen is at least this will put an end to it on an ongoing basis. So there might be a $1 million fine today, but by doing that, you have put an end to the ongoing $1 million per day fines. So if you get fired for something like that, you have to examine your motives, because if you pick up the phone and call the EPA out of spite, well, then that's a serious violation of the rules. But on the other hand, if you're doing it because you want this illegal conduct to end, well, that's permitted under Rule 1.13. Now, there, you don't do that lightly. This is certainly a case where you want to get some outside legal advice before you make that kind of phone call. And also, if you find this kind of issue coming up every day, then I suggest, your life will be a lot less stressful if you get a job somewhere else. Because you don't want to get sucked into all this illegality. But like I say, in those situations, you might have an obligation under Rule 1.13 to be a whistleblower. As I think we mentioned, Rule 1.2, you always have to do everything your client tells you to do, no matter what, even if it's contrary to their best interest, unless Rule 1.14 applies. And there, basically, if they are doing this thing contrary to their best interest, not just because they're doing something dumb, but because they're suffering from diminished capacity, then Rule 1.14 says that this is an exception to Rule 1.2, and you do not have to do exactly what your client tells you to do. But the burden of proof will be on you to show that, yes, I think my client was suffering from a diminished capacity from this, and here I can point to a particular diagnosis of what I think was wrong with the client for doing this. So again, the burden of proof will be on you in that situation. So if your client is about to send the money to the guy in Nigeria because they got an email, well, there's a limit to what you can do to stop them, because if they march out of your office on the way to the Western Union office with a briefcase full of money, you can't stop them and lock them into your office and try to keep them from leaving, unless they're doing it because they're suffering from dementia. So your client who's suffering from dementia is about to send their life savings to the guy in Nigeria that they got an email from. Well, then Rule 1.14 says that you can lock them in your office. Or more likely, talk to their relatives and or set up a guardianship or something. But Rule 1.14 is what gives you that authority to act. But again, the burden of proof will be on you to show that that was necessary. Rule 1.15 says that you have to safeguard your client's property. If your client gives you this briefcase full of gold bars, you have to lock them up properly or whatever. But mostly what Rule 1.15 is talking about the various rules regarding your trust account. Because any time money comes into your hands that does not belong to you in the course of a representation, so in other words, you have money that belongs to your client or you have money that belongs to a third party, that money always, always, always has to go into your trust account. And there are no exceptions to that. It's probably your pooled trust account, but it might be, you know, if it's a large enough amount of money, it might be a separate trust account just for this one client, so that the interest can be earned on it or whatever. But there are really no exceptions to that rule. The corollary to that rule is that money belonging to you must never go in your trust account, and there are two exceptions to that rule. Your money can be in the trust account in only two situations. One is it's money that belongs to you and the client jointly. So in other words, you get the settlement check that it's only one check, but the money belongs to part of it to you, part to your client. You put it in your trust account, and then you distribute it promptly. The other exception is enough money necessary to cover reasonable bank service charges. And one state bar official told one of the attorneys taking my program that $100 is what they say is the proper amount. Because there might be check printing charges or service charges or something, you need to keep enough of your money in the account to cover those. You can't put in an extra $1,000, though, as a cushion because you're bad at math, because that's not a reasonable amount to cover bank service charges. So that's the basic rules under Rule 1.15, keep your trust account. There are specific rules, and here I'm going to assign a little bit of homework to everybody. And your homework is to read your state-specific version of Rule 1.15, because in Minnesota and Iowa, for example, and I think Nebraska, it's a separate document that can be found on your state court website. In Minnesota, it's called, I think, Appendix A. So there's a document called Appendix A to Rule 1.15. And that covers a lot of the little minutiae kinds of rules of exactly what records you have to maintain and exactly how long you have to keep this and what, you know, and very, very specific rules about very specific things that are kind of outside the scope of today's broad program. So if you're in Minnesota, go to the court, and I have a link on the materials to the court website where you can find that Appendix A, and it's called something else in Iowa. You can find it there. In Wisconsin, it's actually written right into the rules. So the Minnesota, Iowa, Nebraska version of Rule 1.15 is like, you know, one page long. The Wisconsin version of Rule 1.15 is about 10 pages long because it has all these minutia rules in there. So like I say, your homework is to go through that and make sure you're complying with everything, because different states have different specific rules. And for example, my Minnesota trust account would be in violation of the Wisconsin rules. Because the Wisconsin rules say that everything associated with your trust account has to have the word trust account printed on it. So your checkbook has to say trust account, and everything has to say trust account, including the bank statement. Well, my Minnesota trust account bank statement does not have the word trust account on it anywhere. It has an abbreviation. The Wisconsin rules make very clear that abbreviations are not permissible. So I would be in big trouble in Wisconsin, even though it's perfectly okay in Minnesota. So like I say, you want to read through those minutia rules, make sure you're okay. One subject that's covered usually in pretty much detail is can you put money in your trust account from a credit card? And in Minnesota, it's actually not too difficult. In Minnesota, what I'm allowed to do is, my client comes in, and say, well, I'll get to work on this, but I need $1,000 in my trust account. And he said, well, do you take Visa? And the answer is yes. I can take the credit card and run it through my personal or through my normal office account, not the trust account. But then I immediately have to put the full $1,000 in my trust account, and I have to eat the service charge that the bank charges me for processing the credit card. I can't I can't put $980 in my trust account. I have to put the full $1,000. Wisconsin, the simple answer of can I accept credit cards from my trust account, the simple answer to that question is no, you can't do it. And now the more complicated answer is yes, if you jump through five pages of hoops, yeah, it's possible in Wisconsin to accept credit cards through your trust account. So if I was in Wisconsin, the client said that same thing, I would say, well, yes, great. Your Visa card looks great. What I want you to do is go down to the bank and get a cash advance, and then bring me a cashier's check, and I'll deposit the cashier's check. Because those hoops in Wisconsin, as far as I can tell, just look too onerous. And the reason why is what the states are worried about on that is the one thing you never want to have happen is have some third party have access to be able to take funds out of your trust account. And if you put money into a trust account using a credit card, if you have a credit card account tied to your trust account, there's always a possibility that somebody will dispute the charge, and then the credit card company can take that money out of your trust account, which is never allowed. So the easy way in most states would just be to say no, bring in a check for your trust account. Rule 1.16 talks about declining. So, but anyway, your homework under Rule 1.15 is to look at your relevant appendix, or for those of you in Wisconsin, read Chapter 45 of the Iowa Court Rules. Or no, that's Iowa. Wisconsin, read Rule 1.15. Rule 1.16 says you can quit whenever you feel like it. Well, it doesn't use those exact words. It lists a bunch of situations and says, yeah, you can quit in the following situations. And they are so inclusive that it, as a practical matter, you can say, yeah, you can quit whenever you feel like it, unless the exception applies. And the reason why I don't spend too much time talking about the rule is because the exception kind of swallows up the rule. And before we do that, let's give another code number, D49. D as in Delta, 49. D49 is our next code number, the first code number for our for the second half of the program, D49. D49 is our next code number. Rule 1.16 says you can quit if any of these situations apply, like including any other good reason. But there's an exception saying you have to comply with any court rules regarding notice or permission before withdrawing. So as a practical matter, if you are representing somebody in a civil case, there will be a rule in the rules of civil procedure in your state saying that before an attorney withdraws, you have to notify the court. And in that case, the court will probably accept it. In your state rules of criminal procedure, it probably says something to the effect of before withdrawing from a criminal case, you need to get the court's permission. So those rules take precedence over Rule 1.16. And it varies a little bit from state to state. In Minnesota, as a practical matter, a criminal court will not allow you to withdraw once you're representing a client. Other states, apparently Iowa, I'm told, is a little bit more lenient about it. And again, Nebraska has that provision allowing you to have a limited appearance. So if you're going to appear for the arraignment, but you definitely don't want to have anything to do with the trial, in Nebraska, you should file that notice of limited appearance. But again, like I say, the court rule takes precedence over this rule. Also, there are situations where you are required to withdraw if the representation will result in a violation of the rules, such as a conflict of interest, or if your physical or mental condition materially impairs your ability, or if you're discharged. It's kind of a weird way of reading the rule. It says the rule says you must quit if you get fired. That's just to stress the fact that the client always has an absolute power to fire you. They can fire you whenever they feel like it, even if it's a breach of contract. And they might owe you damages for not following through on the contract, But you can't keep representing them. They have an absolute power to say, no, I don't want you representing me, or go away. Don't follow me to court. Rule 1.17 talks about the sale of a law practice. Remember, referral fees are not permitted, but if you sell your law practice as a going business, that's kind of like a referral fee, because you're referring people to the new owner. And basically, it's okay as long as it's a bona fide sale of the business, because you're retiring or you're leaving one geographic area or you're leaving one practice area. So you can retire and sell your practice to another lawyer, and you don't just sell the tables and chairs and books, but you're also selling your, you know, the goodwill of the going business. That's permitted, but it has to be a bona fide sale. You can't just retire from the Smith case because I'm selling it to you. No, you can't do that. It has to be really a sale of the business. But fees can't increase as a result of the sale. So, you know, if you buy somebody's law practice, you can't raise the fees for those clients, even though other, you know, your existing clients are paying more maybe. A prospective client is somebody who comes into your office asking, talking about forming an attorney-client relationship. So I have a legal problem, so I come into your office and say, hey, can you represent me on this? And here's what's going on. Rule 1.18 says that the conversations that we have as a result of that are just as confidential as if there had actually been an attorney-client relationship. So, in other words, is this rule subject to abuse? Yeah, it is, because a quote client might come into your office, not even though they know you're not going to want to take their case because it's such a lousy case, but if they blurt out information, well, then you are precluded from representing anybody against them because that information was confidential. As a partial remedy for that, if they blurt out this information to you, your partners can still, the other attorneys in your office can still take cases against this prospective client, but you would have to be screened off. So if you ever see that happening, you know, see somebody coming in and you think they're going to try to pull that on you, you know, you send one person out to talk to them and have everybody else lock themselves in the office so that they're not exposed to anything that the person might say. So anyway, after 2.5 hours almost, we finally got through Rule 1. But Rule 1 is important because it talks about your relationship with your client. So believe it or not, we will finish the rest of the material here in our remaining half hour or 40 minutes or so. Because Rule 2, I guarantee you, will go a lot faster. Rule 2.1 just says that when you are giving advice to your client, yes, you are permitted to give advice based upon things such as moral, economic, social, and political factors. Just because you have a law degree doesn't mean everything, you forgot everything else you know about life. So you are not required to do that, but Rule 2.1 just makes clear that you're allowed to do that. If you are in if you're in Iowa, Wisconsin, or Minnesota, or Nebraska, you don't have to worry about violating Rule 2.2 because you don't have a Rule 2.2. Rule 2.2, which is adopted in a handful of states, including Indiana, I believe, talks about the situation of you mediating disputes between clients. You have two clients that, you know, and they're fighting with each other. How do you deal with that? Rule 2.2 in some states talks about that, but it was so problematic, most states didn't bother adopting that. So the good news is, in Iowa or Wisconsin or Minnesota, I can guarantee that you're never going to get disbarred for violating Rule 2.2. Keep in mind that the following rules, therefore, might have different numbers in different states. So the next rule, in your course materials, if you're following along, it says Iowa Rule 2.3, which is also Wisconsin and Minnesota Rule 2.3. Because in those states they just skipped that number. But in Nebraska, the following rule is called Rule 2.2. You may evaluate a matter affecting a client for use by somebody else. So if your client wants an opinion letter, you know, they want you to write an opinion letter saying, "Dear bank, my client is duly incorporated under the laws of this state," because they need that letter to get a loan. Yeah, you're allowed to do that because that's what they're hiring you for. This rule just makes clear that if you are, before including negative information in any situation like that, if your client tells you to talk to somebody and the information that you're going to give is negative, make sure you get informed consent. So don't just mail a letter saying, "Dear bank, it turns out my client is not duly incorporated. They let their incorporation lapse, so don't give them the loan." Before you mail that letter, you better talk to the client. The next rule, Iowa/Minnesota/Wisconsin Rule 2.4, also known as Nebraska Rule 2.3, says that if you ever serve as a third-party neutral, such as an arbitrator, mediator, or something like that, if people there are unclear on the concept of what exactly your role is, you have to make clear to them that you are not their lawyer. You are the neutral mediator. Rule 2.4 in most states. Nebraska, it's called Rule 2.3. So there, as promised, we got through Rule 2 a lot faster. Rule 3 and Rule 4, we're going to blast through in record speed, not because it's unimportant, because Rule 3 and Rule 4 are very, very important, because these are the rules that say things like you're not supposed to lie, cheat, and steal. Obviously, we don't want lawyers lying, cheating, and stealing in violation of Rules 3 and 4. But I'm going to go through them very fast because, number one, you probably already knew that you're not supposed to lie, cheat, and steal. You really don't need me telling you not to. Number two, maybe you were planning on lying, cheating, and stealing. Well, me telling you not to probably won't make any difference anyway. So most of these rules are very important, but most of them are kind of common sense. So we'll kind of hit the high points, and we'll kind of hit some points that maybe are a little not quite so intuitive. Rule 3.1 says that you're only supposed to bring meritorious claims and contentions. You're not supposed to bring frivolous claims or defenses. With one exception, and no matter how frivolous it is, a person is always entitled to plead not guilty in a criminal case, and criminal case is defined very broadly as meaning any time somebody's liberty is at issue. If they're potentially going to be a deprivation of liberty, then they have the right to plead not guilty, no matter how guilty they are, and put the state to its strict proof of all the elements. But other than that, you're not supposed to bring frivolous claims or defenses. Rule 3.2 says you're not supposed to drag your feet. You're supposed to expedite litigation, but as long as it's consistent with the interest of your clients. So if it's in your client's interest to delay, well, then you should delay, but don't just delay for the sake of delay. You're supposed to be candid toward the court. You're not supposed to make false statements of fact or law, is what's covered by Rule 3.3. And here's where it covers the points about are you required to tell opposing law, and it's pretty limited where you are required to. And in an ex parte situation, you have to be a little bit more open with the court about the negatives of your case. You have to be fair to the other side, is what Rule 3.4 says, and I'm sure all of you are fair when you get to court. And so you're not supposed to obstruct their access to evidence. You're not supposed to falsify evidence, frivolous discovery requests, so forth. One of these, though, maybe this is the kind of thing where you want to push the envelope a little bit. Because one thing you're not supposed to do is request somebody other than your client not voluntarily give information to the other side. So if you're talking to this witness and they tell you what happened, and are you allowed to tell them, "You know what, you don't have to talk to the other lawyer if you don't want to"? Well, some situations that might be the perfectly appropriate thing to say. But when you do say that, make sure that you're aware that this rule applies, and the burden of proof will be on you, basically, to say that you believe that person's interests will not be adversely affected. So be careful when you tell somebody not to talk to the other side. Because that invokes that rule. You're supposed to be impartial when you're in court, and you're supposed to maintain the decorum of the tribunal. And so you don't disrupt a tribunal, it says. The main thing that's covered here that you want to know about is the rules about jury contact. If any jury matter, now if you're a litigator, you know these rules better than I do. You know that you're not supposed to communicate with the lawyer other than in open, or with the juror other than in open court, no matter what it's about. For the non-litigators, though, you have to keep in mind that this rule potentially applies to you, even if you have nothing to do whatsoever with litigation, because it says a lawyer who is not connected with the case is prohibited from communicating with a juror concerning the case. So how could that come into play? Because you don't even know where the courthouse is. You don't do litigation. But your neighbor just got picked for jury duty. And so your neighbor comes over and starts blurting out stuff about, hey, I just got picked for jury duty. And so you say, well, that's great. Thank you for doing your civic duty. And then they start talking about the case. They say, yeah, I think the guy is guilty because he looks, his lawyer looks dishonest or whatever. And they start talking about the case. Well, your neighbor should know better not to do that, because the very last thing the judge told them when he left the courthouse that day was, don't talk about the case with anyone. And that's exactly what they're doing. But you're also in trouble because you're violating this rule, because you're communicating with that juror concerning the case. So you just got sucked into the whole thing. So make sure you distance yourself from that kind of conversation. But in fact, if it's bad enough, if you discover juror misconduct anywhere in the world, you have an obligation to bring that to the court's attention. So, you discover that your Facebook friend in Australia is engaging in juror misconduct. Well, you have to track down the court in Australia and let them know of that, because that's your duty under Rule 3.5. And no ex parte contact is what's also covered there. Trial publicity. You look at Rule 3.6, and at first glance, it looks like they're talking about criminal cases. But Rule 3.6 says that in any jury case, you are not supposed to engage in any kind of public communication that you think might prejudice the jury. So don't go interviewed on TV and say false things about the other side, because that would be a violation of Rule 3.6. But on the other hand, we also have a First Amendment in this country. So if your client is, just getting crucified in the media and you want to get your client's side of the story out there, well, maybe you do want to get that information out there, even though one of the things in the back of your mind is you want to influence the future jurors who might hear this case. I commend you for your representation of your client in doing that. But on the other hand, keep this rule in mind, because somebody might construe Rule 3.6 to say that you were trying to prejudice the jury, whereas in reality, all you wanted to do is get your client's side of the story out there, even though one of your potential audiences was the potential jurors who will be hearing the jury case a year from now or whatever. Rule 3.7 says you're not supposed to be a witness in a case where you're representing someone. Rule 3.8 says if you're a prosecutor, you have a duty to not bring cases unless you think they're supported by probable cause. You have to be careful for that. And also, if you become aware of the fact that you've been a party to some kind of miscarriage of justice, you have kind of an ongoing duty, perhaps depending on your state, even after you have retired from the prosecuting attorney's office, you might have some obligation to undo those problems that happened. We have one case, the Minneapolis city attorney. During our riots we had here last year, we had one case. This woman was caught on camera. She stole a cell phone from a reporter or somebody, and she hit the person, and she threw the cell phone in a fountain. But fortunately, they were able to retrieve the cell phone, and they actually had, the whole thing was on video, and so they had this video of this woman, you know, engaging in assault and everything. So of course they brought in, so they, you know, they have this picture plastered all over the news. And sure enough, all kinds of people came forward and said, "I know who that is. That's so and so." And so this this person was charged with a crime of assault because there she was on camera engaging in this assault. Except, well, it wasn't her. She had an airtight alibi because she was 100 miles away and had 100 witnesses who saw her there. And it was it was this person who looked just like her, but it was just an airtight alibi. And I have to really give credit to the Minneapolis City Attorney's Office on that one. They took their obligations under this very seriously, and as soon as they brought to their attention, they dismissed the charges, and they even said they were sorry. So that goes a long way sometimes. If you were ever under Rule 3.9, if you're ever appearing for a legislative body or administrative agency, so if you're a legislative subcommittee or the city council or something, if you were ever there in a representative capacity, so you can't just pass yourself off as a concerned citizen. You have to disclose the fact that you're there in a representative capacity. So in other words, somebody wants to build a factory across the street from me, from where I live. So I go down to the city council and I say, you know, I think that's great that we have this smelly factory coming in across the street from me. I'm all in favor of economic development. I think that's great. And as a neighboring property owner, I think this zoning request should be granted to have this glue factory put in across the street from me. Well, if I'm actually there on behalf of the owner of that property, I have to disclose that. I have to say, oh, and by the way, I'm getting paid to say this. So you can't just pass yourself off as a concerned citizen. So Rule 3 kind of talks about your duties to the judicial system. Rule 4 talks about your duties to the public in general. You have to be truthful in your statements to others. You can't knowingly make false statements of material fact to a third party. But here, that's Rule 4.1. On the other hand, sometimes you have to zealously represent your client. So what about a legitimate investigative technique, such as using a tester, for example? So, for example, you have a client comes in and thinks they were discriminated against in housing. They were denied an apartment because of their race. How do you prove that? Well, you need to gather some circumstantial evidence. So you send in two testers. You hire two actors, one of whom is white, one of whom is black, and send them into the landlord's office, and they say, "Hello, we want to rent an apartment." The black person is told, "I'm sorry, we don't have any apartments." The white person is told, "Yes, let's take a look at this apartment." That's a slam dunk. You are to be commended for that. But you have to be aware of Rule 4.1, because those people were making false statements on your behalf. Because they said, "We want to rent an apartment." That was a lie. They did not want to rent an apartment. They were just there to gather evidence. So, when courts look at that, they say, no, that's a legitimate investigative technique. But whenever you do things like that, be aware of Rule 4.1, because you're kind of pushing the envelope. One thing you're not allowed to do under Rule 4.2 is communicate with people that you know are represented by an attorney. So in that same scenario, if you know that the landlord already has a lawyer and they're lawyered up, well, you can't do that because you're not allowed to communicate directly with somebody who's represented by a lawyer, even through a third party like your actors that you hired. So you have to be careful there. An unrepresented person, you have to be careful. Don't give legal advice other than the legal advice to get their own legal advice. State or imply that you were disinterested in dealing with third parties. You have to respect the rights of third parties. You can't, break into somebody's house to gather evidence or whatever. That would be a violation of Rule 4.4. And also, this Rule 4.4 covers the situation. I think this was added after I graduated from law school. What do you do? This rule was written in the age of the fax machine. But what do you do if you get a fax that's addressed that is obviously not intended for you? And that never happened to me, but it happens more often with emails. You receive an email that was not intended for you, but they accidentally sent it to you. You have to promptly notify the sender. Do you have to destroy it? Well, no, you have to notify the sender under this rule. And you have to be careful, and that's... I thought I was being super careful. That would never happen to me, because when you send something, always look up in the to field. You know, look up in the headers, make sure where you're sending it to. You have to be careful of. I got an email from the client or from the other attorney, and I forwarded it to my client. And I probably told my client, boy, this other lawyer, he's really a jerk, isn't he? And I forwarded this to my client along with my editorial comment. And then my client replied to me and she said, I don't know, yes, he is a jerk, isn't he? But unbeknownst to either of us, I forwarded the email to her and she clicked the reply button on her phone. And unbeknownst to either of us, when you reply to a forwarded email, you're not just replying to the person who's forwarded it to you, you're replying to the original person. So she basically sent to the I didn't do it, but the client did it. It didn't do any harm because this guy knew he was a jerk anyway. But you have to be careful with that. So what I've taken to when I forward emails like that, I do not forward them anymore. I cut and paste and I expunge the opposing attorney's email address. So if there's no possibility that my client will accidentally click on something and accidentally send it to them. Rule 5 covers kind of the respondeat superior issues. Rule 5.1 and 5.3 says that you as the boss are responsible for other people in your office. So first of all, obviously if you tell somebody to break the rules, you are responsible for that violation. But you have to have systems in place to make sure that the rules are followed in your office. That's rules 5.1 and 5.3. Rule 5.2 says that talks about your obligations as the employee. And rule 5.2 says that the I was only following orders defense is not a defense. You are guilty of a violation of the rules even if you're acting because your boss told you to do it. So your boss said, hey, break this rule for me. Well, you're just as responsible as the boss is, unless it is not a violation if you act in accordance with your boss's reasonable resolution of an arguable question. So if you really don't know what to do and you ask your boss, what should I do in this weird situation? Is this a conflict of interest or is this a violation of rule or whatever? And your boss says, no, that's okay, you go ahead and do that. And it turns out your boss is wrong, you are protected even though you're wrong because you acted in accordance with a reasonable resolution of that arguable question. Rule 5.4 says don't share fees with a non-lawyer. So, for example, you can't have a partnership between a lawyer and a CPA where, the CPA is getting, the legal fees, whatever. That's not permitted. So you can't share fees with a non-lawyer, with a couple of exceptions like a deceased attorney or something, or maybe a profit-sharing plan that's otherwise permitted by law. Rule 5.5 is entitled Unauthorized Practice of Law. Well, the one thing that you are incapable of as an attorney is the unauthorized practice of law. Because why? Well, because you're authorized. So you can't engage in the unauthorized practice of law. The rule says you're not supposed to assist others in doing that. But where Rule 5.5 comes into play is, what are you allowed to do in other states? So you are admitted in Wisconsin only. Can you come to Minnesota to take a deposition? Can you go to Iowa to file a lawsuit in federal court? Can you give legal advice to people in Illinois? This rule answers those kinds of questions. Now, the important thing to keep in mind is when those kinds of questions come up, you are not concerned with what your state's version of Rule 5.5 has to say. You have to take a look at the other state's version of Rule 5.5 in answering those questions. Now, fortunately for most of us, it's the same, because with very, very minor exceptions, the Rule 5.5 in almost every state is identical. The question is, can I go to Wisconsin to take a deposition? The answer is the same as, can you come to Minnesota to take a deposition? But if I go to Wisconsin to take a deposition, I have to look at Wisconsin Rule 5.5 to make sure that that's okay. Similarly, if you come to Minnesota to take a deposition, you have to look at Minnesota Rule 5.5 to make sure it's okay. So what are you allowed to do in other states? Quite a bit, actually. You can work in association with a lawyer who is admitted in that state who actively participates in the matter. So let's say you, in your Wisconsin office, you are just totally backlogged and you need help catching up on work. So you temporarily bring me in to help you catch up on your work. You're actively participating in everything that I'm working on, but I can do anything a Wisconsin attorney can do because you are actively participating in the matter. So I can talk to your clients and tell them the meaning of the Wisconsin statutes, and I can prepare Wisconsin documents, and I can do almost anything. I probably can't go to court without getting the court's permission, but everything that you can do, I can do under Rule 5.5. I can do things that are reasonably related to my practice back home. So yes, I can go to Wisconsin to take a deposition in my Minnesota case, and I don't have to hire a Wisconsin attorney to help me out. The services are not ones that require pro hac vice admission, so I can't go to court. The powerful one that allows you really do a lot is number two on my list here in the materials. Services that are reasonably related to a pending or potential proceeding, if I reasonably expect to be authorized by law or order to appear. So I go to Wisconsin because I want to, I'm hiring this client in Wisconsin is hiring me because we have a potential federal case that's going to be filed in the federal district court in Wisconsin. I am not admitted in Wisconsin. I am not admitted in the Federal District Court in Wisconsin. I'm not admitted in the Seventh Circuit. I have nothing to do with Wisconsin. But I look at the Wisconsin court rules for the federal court, and lo and behold, it says there that if I want to get admitted to practice in Wisconsin federal court, it's no problem. I just send in the proper paperwork, and I will automatically get admitted. As soon as I know that piece of information, I can start getting ready for that future federal case, even before I get admitted. And perhaps the federal case gets resolved long before we get to federal court. Well, almost anything could potentially turn into a federal lawsuit, or I might discover that I can get waived in to practice in the state courts as well. Anything can wind up in the state courts. So that's kind of a powerful thing that you can do. Anything that might potentially wind up in litigation in that other state, you can do that. Again, the key thing, though, is to look at the other state's version of Rule 5.5. So I have, I have clients in other states all the time for various things. It's not a big deal because Rule 5.5 in those other states is usually pretty wide open and accommodating for me in those situations. However, one time I got an email from somebody in California, and they said, "Hey, can you do this for me?" And if that person had been in Wisconsin or Iowa or Illinois or something, I would say, "Hey, no problem," because Rule 5.5 clearly authorizes me to do that. But I took a look at the comparable California rule, And well, I had to say no because it would have constituted the criminal unauthorized practice of law in California, and I would be in San Quentin right now. So, so you do have to check the other state's version of that rule. Even though I can do a bunch of stuff in another state, I can't hold myself out as admitted to practice in that state, obviously. But I can't establish an office or systematic presence in that state to practice law. One guy taking this program, the issue came up is I forget what state he was admitted in. I think he was admitted in Minnesota. And he had some kind of a federal practice or whatever. Kind of a virtual practice. He can be anywhere. But he lived in another state. So the question was, is he allowed to live in that state and practice law? So we decided the best thing to do would be for him to maintain a mailing address back home, because otherwise his only address, stuff has to get mailed to him, so he has the address in this state. And we thought, maybe that's too close to having an office or systematic presence. So, he rented a mailbox at the UPS store back in this old state. Rule 5.6, don't engage in, basically covenants not to compete, because lawyers can't do that. You have to maintain your independence. Rule 5.7 does not apply in Wisconsin, but it does apply in Nebraska, Iowa, Minnesota, and many other states. And it talks about what about you are engaging in things called law-related services. In other words, things that are not the practice of law do not require you to be a lawyer, but they may be kind of sort of connected to the practice of law, such as tax preparation, for example. The question is, if I decide to start a tax preparation business, I go into competition with H&R Block. You don't want me preparing your taxes, but I decide to go into that business. Do the rules of professional conduct apply to me when I'm doing that business? And Rule 5.7 answers that question. And the answer is yes, if it's not distinct from the practice of law. So if I have a combination law office / tax preparation business, then all of my tax preparation clients are entitled to the full protection of the attorney-client relationship. Whereas if I get a part-time job at H&R Block and nobody even knows I'm a lawyer, then those rules don't apply in that business. In Wisconsin, if you're practicing as an LLC, there's a separate rule 5.7 that governs that. In addition to the general LLC statute in Wisconsin. So if you're operating as a limited liability organization, you want to read Rule 5.7. Rule 6 talks about pro bono. It says you shall aspire to do 50 hours of pro bono per year. And what you're supposed to aspire to is services for persons of limited means in their ordinary legal work at no cost or vastly reduced cost. You're supposed to aspire to do your 50 hours. And in addition, you're also supposed to do things like, protect civil rights, public rights, help other charitable organizations, et cetera, et cetera. But those other public service activities are not, there's no hour limit associated with them. You're supposed to kind of keep that stuff in mind too. You're supposed to, without any specific hour limitation, you're supposed to participate in activities to improve the law and the legal system, and if possible, make financial contributions to those kinds of organizations. Now, in 6.2, you shall not seek to avoid appointments by a tribunal. So if the court is looking for somebody to, represent this indigent defendant, you can't try to sneak out of the courthouse to avoid that. Those are your pro bono obligations. Rules 6.3 through the end talk about some of the exceptions to the conflict of interest rules as a result of that. So, yes, it's a laudable thing. We want you doing things like being on the board of directors of the legal services organization, but those clients might have cases adverse to your own clients. So normally that would be a big conflict of interest, but in that pro bono public service law firm situation, you don't have to, you know, resign from the board, but you have to disclose that and recuse yourself. I'm going to give another code number at this point. Let's see, the next code number is E72 is our next to the last code number while we finish up our next 10 minutes or so of the program. E as in echo, 72, E72. If you, another laudable thing you're supposed to do is law reform activities. You're supposed to, you know, if they ask you to serve on the Bar Association Committee to rewrite the probate code, and because you're a probate lawyer, well, you should rise to that occasion. But maybe your current clients like the code the way it is, you know, and so you have to disclose the fact that your law reform activities affect your current clients. If you ever serve in a legal services clinic, so like a clinic associated with a bar association or a law school or something like that, you know, you're giving advice to people who just walk in off the street to, you know, to the law day celebration at the mall and asking, you know, what to do. And you give them advice in general terms. You say, well, you know, you should sue that insurance company that did that bad thing to you. And it turns out that insurance company, unbeknownst to you, was your client. Well, you don't have to be quite as strict about screening for conflicts of interest in those public interest clinic situations. Okay, in our last 10 or so minutes here, communications. 7.1 says, anytime you communicate with the public, you have to be truthful. Don't make false or misleading statements about yourself or about your services. 7.2 says that, first of all, as we covered before, you're not supposed to pay referral fees. You're not supposed to accept referral fees because you shall not give anything of value to anybody to recommend your services. There are some exceptions. One of them is an advertisement. Because if you're advertising, you know, you're paying the newspaper to print this ad saying that come to this lawyer. So if you're paying the reasonable cost of an advertisement, advertising is legal. So that's basically what Rule 7.2 says. Advertising is legal. And the only substantive requirement for your advertisement is that any advertisement must include the name of at least one lawyer or law firm who is responsible for its content. So if you put up a billboard at the dangerous intersection saying, hey, injured, call 1-800-INJURY, you have to put the name of your law firm there. You can't just put your phone number. So you have to disclose whose ad it is. But other than that, advertising is okay. And so are lawyer referral programs. They're discussed also in Rule 7.2. One form of advertising that's always been allowed, interestingly, is direct contact with prospective clients. So in other words, you go down to the jail and get the name of everybody who got arrested over the weekend and send them a letter saying, hey, I can represent you. I'm a criminal defense attorney. That's actually okay. That's permitted. It's always permitted. Different states have different specific rules, though. In most states, the letter that you send, as well as the outer envelope, has to have some magic words on them. In most states, that's the words advertising material. You have to print that in a specific size font before you send it to them. And in Wisconsin and many other states, you are required to send a copy of such advertisements to the relevant office of your state Supreme Court. So there's an affidavit that you have to accompany that saying, you know, I sent out this letter on so-and-so date, and here's a copy of the advertising letter that I sent out. Minnesota does not have that requirement. I don't think Iowa does. I forget about Nebraska. But in any state, if you're going to engage in that kind of advertising, look carefully at Rule 7.3 before you have that direct contact with people that you think might be in need of services. So, you know, go to the small claims court, get the names of all the judgments, and send them out a letter saying, I practice bankruptcy, or whatever. So read Rule 7.3 very carefully before you do that. Yes, you're allowed to say what you do for a living, is what Rule 7.4 says. So if you, you know, yeah, I do DWI, or I do personal injury, or whatever. There are many ways you can word that, but don't use the C word or the S word. Those, of course, are certified or specialist or any variation thereof. Because if you use those words in your advertising, just wipe those words from your vocabulary. Because if you use those words, a special set of rules kick in. Because, you know, if you're a certified real property specialist by the Wisconsin State Bar Association, then you can advertise that. And different states have different rules of exactly how that has to be, but they all boil down to you really have to be certified by a real certifying agency, such as a bar association. Iowa, so in Minnesota and Wisconsin, there are specific provisions for, there's a list somewhere of everybody who you're allowed to use the word certified in connection with. In Iowa, they don't have that, and if you have to say that the Supreme Court of Iowa does not certify lawyers as specialists to practice law, and certification is not required. So again, check your state rules carefully. The sad story of the attorney who got himself into trouble was the New York lawyer who put on his LinkedIn profile. He said, I specialize in tough cases. And the state bar came to him and said, oh, can I see your certification as a specialist by the National Association of Tough Cases? And, well, of course, he didn't have that. So if he said, I love tough cases, that would have been different. But he said, I specialize in tough cases. So they, I forget what happened to that attorney, but at the very least they made him take down the S word off of his ad. Rule 7.5 says your firm can practice under a trade name. Two things to watch out for. It can't imply a connection with a state or public charitable organization. Some Supreme Courts say that the word clinic implies that you're a nonprofit. So if I started a law practice and called myself the Clem Legal Clinic, well, I might run into trouble for that, because some courts have looked at, I don't know if Minnesota has, but some courts have looked at that and said, no, the word clinic implies that you're a nonprofit. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me, but so don't use that word. The other main thing to be careful, though, is if you start a law firm name, don't use a geographic name that's a political subdivision. So don't call yourself Wisconsin Divorce Lawyers, or don't call yourself Des Moines Personal Injury or whatever. The reason for that is because when you use the name of a state or a city or a county, the reasoning is, well, it sounds like you're a state agency. So I'm in Minneapolis, Minnesota. I certainly can't call myself Minneapolis Attorneys because, well, there's a government office called Minneapolis City Attorney. But anything including a political subdivision is problematic. So if I was going to do that, I would call it, you know, City of Lakes Attorneys or Badger State Divorce or whatever. It would probably be safer. These rules might also apply to your law firm URL. So MadisonAttorneys.com might be problematic. Those rules vary a little bit from state to state. Don't pay political contributions with the hopes of obtaining legal engagements or appointments. Sounds kind of like bribery. It's also a violation of Rule 7.6. In our remaining 5 minutes here, we're going to cover Rule 8, which is miscellaneous. Rule 8.1 says, in connection with bar admissions or disciplinary matters, yours or anybody else's, you have to don't knowingly make false statements to the bar authorities. you also have to clear up misunderstandings. So, you know, if you get a letter saying, what do you know about this bar applicant? And you happen to be aware of the fact that he's guilty of a felony. Well, you have to let on if they have a misapprehension, unless the information was confidential because of it was in connection with a representation. Don't knowingly or recklessly make false statements about judges or candidates for judicial office. Don't knowingly make false statements about the qualifications or integrity of judges or candidates for judicial office. In states like Minnesota and Wisconsin, where we have contested judicial races, you have to be careful what you say about not only the incumbent. I think Judge so-and-so is a crook. Well, if you say that, the guy better be a crook. But that also applies to the person running against them. They are entitled to that same level of protection. So don't say, I think this person running for office is a crook, unless they really are a crook. Now, interestingly enough, in states like Iowa that just have judicial retention elections, they still use the phrase candidate for judicial office. And I don't know exactly what a candidate for judicial office is in Iowa, unless perhaps it's somebody who put themselves, their name in nomination to the judicial recommendation board or whatever, because that language is true state in all states. Rule 8.3, you are required, if you ever run for judge in states where you can run for judge, or you put your name in contention, I guess, you become subject to the rules of judicial conduct at that point as well. You are required to report professional misconduct on the part of other lawyers or judges. So if you become aware that another lawyer or judge is committing some kind of misconduct, you have a duty to report that, unless you gained that information because it's confidential, because you are representing that person, and it's confidential under Rule 1.6, or if you are gained that information as part of a lawyer's assistance program. In Minnesota, Iowa, and most other states have a lawyer's assistance program. So if you help attorneys with chemical dependency problems or whatever, the information that you gain as a volunteer counselor with that organization, that's confidential, and you're not required to report that to authorities. 8.4 covers miscellaneous, everything we didn't think of. So if you do something that is dishonest that is not listed elsewhere, it's still a violation according to Rule 8.4. And different states added different things to the miscellaneous list. So, for example, Nebraska says if you're willfully not paying child support, that's a violation. That would probably be a violation somewhere else if it involved dishonesty. Discriminatory acts are generally a violation. Whether or not they're in connection with the practice of law, it's a worse offense if you discriminate within the practice of law. We have about 2 minutes left. Before we do that, I'm just going to give our final code number, F as in Fox 81. F81 is our last code number before we just wrap up Rule 8.5. Again, F81. And Rule 8.5 talks about disciplinary authority. If you're admitted in one state, obviously the state you're admitted in has disciplinary authority over you. If you're admitted, but if you engage in the practice of law in another state, legally or illegally, so if I go to Wisconsin to take that deposition, well, the Wisconsin Supreme Court has disciplinary authority over me. They could fine me or whatever. Choice of law. If you're just admitted in one state, you don't have to worry about it too much. But if your conduct has its predominant effect in another state, and the other state has a different law, then that would apply. So, for example, the California thing. I give advice to somebody in California. in violation of the California rules saying I'm not allowed to give advice to California residents, that state's law would apply to me. If you're admitted in more than one state, in general, you go based upon the state where you have your principal place of business. If I were admitted in Minnesota and Michigan, I would go by the Minnesota rules, even though I'm also admitted in Michigan, unless it has a connection with that state. And the one time that issue came up was did involve Michigan, because Michigan has referral fees. They're okay. So I had this attorney in Michigan who had her office in Michigan. She was admitted in Michigan. She was also admitted in another state. So she said, would I get in trouble if I accepted a referral fee? And we decided that if it's a Michigan case, the rules of the state where she has her principal office would apply. So anyway, that brings us to the end. I'll repeat that last code number again. F81 was the final of our six code numbers. So at this point, I will pause briefly, see if there are any questions from our live audience today. And, hearing none, thank you very much for joining us. I'll stop the recording here in just a second, but I'll just remind our podcast listeners that email me and or put them in affidavit form if required, if you're an Iowa attorney. Email those to me so I can record your attendance. If you have any substantive questions about the program, feel free to give me a call or send me an email, 612-378-7751 or clem.law@usa.net, and I'll answer those within the time stipulated by the rules. So thank you very much for joining us today, and I look forward to seeing you at future programs.